everyone. This is Dee Nicholson on Zero Point Radio, bbsradio.com, and we're coming to you on September the 14th, Saturday. Lovely day here in Toronto, and I hope everyone's enjoying better weather than we've all had over the last little while, especially those poor people down in Colorado. Bless them, they're they are under rock slides and everything else, and I guess we won't have too many listeners from that state today, but, you know, this is an important show. With us today is a lady who is doing a service to all of us by heading up an organization called Seniors at Risk Coalition. Seniors at Risk is an organization that essentially takes on battles with provincial guardian and trustees office and stands up for seniors' rights across the country and is, you know, collaborating with other groups around the world doing the same thing. And when you hear the horror stories that go on in terms of the care and feeding and maintenance of our senior people once they come into a system of so-called medical care and so-called protection, it is enough to make you throw up dinner in a hell of a hurry. It is an awful, awful thing that is going on, and very few people don't know about it well enough in advance to protect themselves once one of their family members gets sucked into that system. And legal protections like powers of attorney and substitute decision maker status, they don't seem to hold an awful lot of weight when it comes to the government. There are many, many things that we need to be aware of and care about, because the senior's life that you save may be your own or your parents or your grandparents. You know, it's like we're all getting older, and there's always a point at which we need some help. These people in our care homes are not getting, unfortunately, the guaranteed care they are supposed to have. So without further ado, let me welcome to the show today Lois Sampson of Seniors at Risk Coalition, who has some absolutely incredible stories to tell us. And then later on in the show, we're going to open up the phone lines, and if you have horror stories to tell about your family, about things that you have gone through or have observed others go through, please do call in and share these stories. We'll let you know when, and we'll let you know the number. For the moment, welcome, Lois, and thank you for joining us today. This is a really important show.
Thank you for having me, dear. It's good to be on.
Oh, it's great to have you, because these, like, as I was saying, this is an issue that is under-discussed and under-known. You know, people don't think about these things, and then they get sucked in. So, you know, I am a witness, as you know, I'm a witness to one particular case here in Ontario involving a gentleman by the name of Arthur Hippie. And Arthur is a friend of mine going back many years, at least a decade. And Arthur is in a horrible situation, but he's only the tip of the iceberg. So tell us about this iceberg, Lois.
All right. Well, our organization, Seniors at Risk, exists to help seniors and their families when they encounter problems with the healthcare system and or the legal system. And that includes hospitals, nursing homes, public agencies like the public guardian and trustee, like health regions, health networks, health authorities. They're known by different names in different provinces. So when people encounter the healthcare system, they often are shocked to find that their rights, the rights that they have always thought they had as Canadians, to make decisions for themselves or to have others appoint make decisions for them, those rights suddenly disappear when they enter the healthcare system. And so we have a number, we deal with cases where people are either the seniors themselves are having difficulties, or their families are concerned about their welfare. They perhaps might be in a hospital or a nursing home, and all of a sudden they are shut out from decision making, and in many cases they are prevented from even seeing their loved ones or making decisions on their behalf, even if they have the legal authority to do so.
And how are these agencies getting by all this stuff? Do they just ignore these legal documents? I mean, we are under the impression that when we appoint a power of attorney, that person takes over our rights and represents us and what our decisions would be were we in full capacity. So how is it that the governments get to stomp all over those rights and these agents, I mean, it's flabbergasting to me. I'm reading a backgrounder here that you supplied, and I know the background of Mr. Hippie's case, and in both of these cases, it seems that legal documents were just tossed aside as though they had no force in effect.
Yes, that is very common right across Canada, that whether it be powers of attorney some other sort of health care decision-making document, for example, in British Columbia, it's called a representation agreement, but it's the same essentially as the power of attorney for personal care that, for example, Ontario has, where you are. Those documents are often ignored by health care providers, by nursing homes, by hospitals, and also by public agencies like the public guardian and trustee. And it seems somewhat unbelievable that government authorities would ignore legal documents, but they do, and they do that routinely. We have case after case after case where the we've examined all the records in the particular case, and indeed we have documented evidence of those documents being ignored, or the families being misled and told them they're not valid, or the families or the senior being told something different, like it's the doctor's decision, the doctor will decide, and so forth. So that's one way. They are being ignored. They are legal documents. They're being ignored. And people are initially, they're just dumbfounded. They don't know quite what to do with that kind of a situation. In a lot of cases, people will try to exert their legal authority to make decisions about themselves, or if it's a substitute decision maker, someone holding the power of attorney for personal care or a representation agreement for making health care decisions, when they try to exert their authority and ask, for example, for records, medical records, which they are entitled to by law, or tell the doctor that they or the person that they are responsible for do not give consent to a particular drug, then often they are misled, or they have the care facilities start to step up their actions with respect to the family that might be concerned, and so forth. In many cases, family members have been banned because they've raised objections. People holding legal powers of attorney for personal care have been banned. Their visits have been restricted, and so forth. So that's the next step in terms of how these legal documents are ignored. And the reason that hospitals and nursing homes can do that is because they operate under other laws that permit them to essentially ban anyone they wish to from visiting the facility and so forth.
Wow. And of course, that banning situation was actually applied in the hippie case, was it not? His spouse was denied access to him, and then when that, and she was actually, was she not put under a restraining order that she could not be on hospital grounds, she was a dangerous person? And on top of that, when they finally did get that restraining order lifted because it was bogus and illegal in the first place, then her visitations were restricted to, what, an hour a day?
Yes, that's correct. That's correct.
Yeah, and under supervision.
And that's correct. And in this particular case, Mr. Hippie's spouse was met one evening as she came into the hospital with a hot meal, as she had been doing this, bringing his meals on a daily basis, and she was met with two security guards who handed her an envelope, a letter, and that letter told her that she had been banned from the premises, the entire premises. She was not permitted to set foot on it. And she was immediately escorted out by two security guards. The letter did not say why she was banned. She found out by simply speaking to the security guards that apparently a nurse had complained that she had slapped her husband the night before. She was shocked and dumbfounded. She reported this immediately that same night to the police. The police investigated and found that there was no substantiation for the allegation whatsoever. There was simply no evidence and no substantiation for the allegation.
No, of course there wouldn't be. I mean, I know both parties involved here, and I can't imagine any circumstance where what they were claiming would be true. I can't imagine it.
Right. And, you know. And the it was determined that the nurse who alleged that the man's wife had slapped him admitted afterwards that she didn't really see the whole scenario, and in fact he could have been flailing with his hands and so forth, and so there was really nothing to it, but here's the upshot. The police investigated the situation and came to that conclusion within the week, and still Mr. Hippie's wife was, the ban continued for 5 weeks, right? And so it was without any reason for that ban.
Him with no visitation at all from anyone, because his wife was the only one who was coming to see him on a daily basis, and she was essentially, in large measure, responsible for keeping him as healthy as he was staying, because he had that emotional contact and support. But then they took it away from him completely to punish her for something she didn't do.
It wasn't simply the denial of contact with the only other visitor that he has on a regular basis. It was when she saw him again, she was permitted to see him after 5 weeks, she was shocked at the weight loss, shocked. And so that was another aspect. And so both of those are extremely serious, the denial of companionship of one's spouse and the rapid weight loss that she saw had occurred while she was not there bringing him meals and so forth and looking after nutrition.
Yeah.
And as I said,
I knew this man for 10 years. He has always been a hefty man. You know, he was nearly 200 pounds when he was, you know, fully healthy, and now I know. I watched a lot of that weight loss myself. And I didn't see him regularly, so it was shocking to me. You know, if I saw him a month and a half later, he would have lost more weight. Well, now I know he's lost about a third of his body weight. I know he's suffered contractures of his muscles, and that leaves him in a semi-fetal position. And, of course, they've given him absolutely no physiotherapy in the 3 years they've held on to him. And furthermore, the physio is supposed to be on his treatment plan, yet none of it has been done. They claimed, and I know this for a fact because I was there, they claimed that they were providing him with soothing music. Well, he wasn't provided with anything soothing because Marilyn herself brought in, that's his wife, brought in a radio for him. And the hospital certainly didn't supply any of that. And I know that they also put some kind of a crazy ban on visitation of Arthur because they said he was infected with one of those hospital bacteria. And then his wife had to wear protective clothing. They would come in and they would wipe off her seat if she'd been sitting on it. She wasn't allowed to do this, that, the other thing. I mean, it was totally crazy. Everything was crazy. And in the meantime, they isolated the man in a darkened room 24/7. And now they don't let him go outside at all, do they?
No. Arthur Hickey has not had a breath of fresh air for over 2 years. And as a matter of fact, in the last few months, for some reason that's not given by the hospital, his wife is not allowed to even wheel him up and down the corridor of the ward that he's in. He is confined to his room for no medical reason that has been given. So this man is essentially, many people have described it as being a prisoner, and in fact, probably prisoners get a few more rights in this than Arthur Hippie has.
They get a lot more rights, and on top of which, they are by law entitled to an hour exercise and fresh air per day, by law. So that's even for prisoners in isolation, unless they have particularly egregious and violent circumstances. These people are allowed out. They are given, if they can't be in contact with other people, they are given a private space to be outside for an hour a day, and they have physical exercise. They have their meals, they have all kinds of privileges, this, that, the other thing, and they can earn more. Arthur, on the other hand, is stuck in a very bland, very boring, and very quiet hospital room. And the only thing
it's not all that quiet. If you've ever been in a hospital room, and in this one in particular, and I have visited him on a number of occasions, it is a very noisy place. You don't get any peace and quiet. It's not soothing noise either. It's a lot of distraction, lights on for most of the time. It's an institution, and it's a functioning institution. So that is his home at this point in time. And he does not get, as I say, he does not get out. He is not. His wife is no longer permitted to even wheel him out of the room. I should just let listeners know that his wife has a legal power of attorney for personal care. The hospital ignored that all the way along from the moment almost to the very moment he was he entered the hospital after having a stroke. She was being urged to put a do not resuscitate order on his chart, and she did not want that. So she wrote a letter to the doctor and just said, no, I don't want a DNR code on his chart. Mm-hmm. The hospital ignored that. When we got hospital records later, it was clear that they ignored that, and without letting her know, they put a DNR, do not resuscitate code, on his chart. The other thing, they have been ignoring her power of attorney for a long time. She's objected to medications, certain medications. I should explain, Mr. Hippy had a stroke, and as a result of his stroke, he's not comatose at all. He has left side paralysis on his left side, and he is largely unable to speak. He can speak a few words or phrases from time to time, and just in the last couple of months, for the first time in three years, he's able to speak full coherent sentences and has begun to laugh again, and so that is very encouraging. So this is a man who's not in a coma. He's not on a respirator. He does not have a feeding tube. He doesn't have a catheter. He is simply someone. He cannot walk. And so therefore he needs a wheelchair to get around, and he needs a lift for transfer from his bed to his chair.
Mm-hmm.
So he's not a vegetable by any means at all, and yet when he was within the first week of him having been hospitalized, his wife was urged by the doctor to just let him go.
Yeah.
And she was dumbfounded by this. She was stunned, horrified, actually. And she said, let him go. Well, you know, he's had a stroke, but he's certainly not on his deathbed. And she was encouraged, and they just explained that, because he was having difficulty eating at the time, they would simply, you know, just not feed him, and he would not give him water, and he would simply expire that way. And she was just horrified. She got a second medical opinion. She went to a neurologist. The neurologist agreed with her and said, Arthur does not have to die. And she said he should not be on particular antipsychotic drugs that they had started to give him shortly after he was hospitalized, and that he should be getting physiotherapy and speech therapy, and that although he would not likely recover all of his, you know, full function, that he was a good candidate to recover a lot. He never, ever got any physiotherapy or speech therapy, and the doctors at the hospital ignored the specialist's recommendation about the medication, and they have been essentially administering very powerful antipsychotic drugs to Mr. Hippie for most of the last 3 years.
Yeah, and I want to emphasize to people who are listening, I am here to verify every single thing Lois has said here, because I was the witness to the power of attorney. I was one of two witnesses to the power of attorney being signed, giving Marilyn the power of attorney over Arthur's continuing care. And I was a witness to a great many things that this hospital did. I was privy to a meeting in which not only myself, but also the legal team that was brought in, we sat in a meeting with hospital executives and doctors Staff and Price, who are the two who are primarily in charge of Arthur's case. And I asked the doctors, I said, you've got him on Zyprexa. Are you aware that Zyprexa has been the subject and the cause of the largest criminal fine in U.S. court history? This was a criminal fine that was levied against the makers of Zyprexa because they lied and mismarketed it, and they were fined over $1 billion in total, was it not, Lois?
I don't have that particular figure with me,
I think it was $1.1 billion when you added it all up.
It was a large figure, but then many of the pharmaceutical companies have paid fines for all kinds of
infractions. Oh, yeah, chump change to them.
So that's just one of many. And
yeah.
he was receiving over the past 3 years quite a number of antipsychotic medications.
Yeah, including Haldol.
And Haldol being another, Risperidone, and so on and so forth. Now, and so Amanda Nelson was concerned about that and concerned about other things as well. And in June of 2012, a year and a half ago almost, the hospital decided to declare Arthur Hippe palliative. He does not have a terminal illness, but they decided that he is dying. And they put him on palliative care. And palliative care sounds nice, and in some, and for people who have terminal illness, it can be a blessing. And I work with doctors, many good doctors, some of whom are palliative care physicians, and I know that they can provide loving care in a palliative care setting, very, very wonderful care. However, just calling something palliative care does not mean the person is, as a patient, is going to be receiving good quality care. And bear in mind, Arthur Hippe has no terminal illness, and his legal power of attorney for personal care, his legal substitute decision maker, as well as his family, his sister, also object to this designation. They do not want Arthur Hippe on palliative care, and the reason being is that, amongst other things, he would not, if, for example, he got pneumonia and a simple antibiotic treatment would arrest that immediately, he won't get it because there's no, as far as palliative care goes, it's understood that that person is going to be dying, so they will take no measures to protect anyone's health. So even if he caught a very simple, if he caught a cold that turned into pneumonia or something, whatever the case may be, if he picked up a bug in the hospital, nothing would be done to try to protect his health. So in fact, if palliative care is not administered in good faith by people who are acting in good faith, then it really is a lesser form of health care, and that's what Arthur Hippe is getting now, against the family wishes. So what his wife did was she appealed to a lower court in Ontario, a quasi-judicial body. It's called the Consent and Capacity Board. She wanted to have her power of attorney for personal care asserted and confirmed and have the doctors comply with it. And the doctors filed an application as well. They applied to have her
declared incompetent.
Well, not declared incompetent. They actually wanted...
they did that earlier, though.
Go ahead. Sorry.
Yeah, they did try earlier on to have Marilyn declared incompetent. That was much earlier. They've been trying to beat her down for years. The woman is incredible in terms of her support. You know, and now...
This is absolutely true, yes.
I mean, what you're talking about now is much more recent and is, in fact, an ongoing situation where now I understand a factum has been presented. She's having to appeal the ruling of the Consent and Capacity Board. Now, correct me if I'm wrong here. What the Consent and Capacity Board did was they said, oh, yeah, we're going to confirm that you are the substitute decision maker, but your decision is going to be to follow the path that the doctors have said. Otherwise, we're going to take that away from you. So net response from the Consent and Capacity Board was zero.
That is correct. There is one other thing. There were three applications asking for a decision from the Consent and Capacity Board. Marilyn Nelson was confirmed as Arthur Hippe's legal substitute decision maker. And you're quite right. In almost the next breath, I like to say, they then turned around and said, however, the only decision you have that you are allowed to make is to rubber stamp the doctor's wishes in terms of treatment and so forth. And there, and that you must consent with the treatment plan of the doctors. And that treatment plan includes administration of far more Haldol than he has been on in the past. So that's a problem. But there was a third, there's a third application to the Consent and Capacity Board, which Marilyn Nelson was successful on as well. And that is, there was a third doctor, a Dr. Stephen Fishman, also at Ajax Pickering Hospital, that was found to have acted illegally in since March of 2011, when he without informing Marilyn Nelson, the legal substitute decision maker, declared Mr. Hippy incapable of managing his finances, which is understandable. He's not in a position to do that. However, what the doctor then did was to submit this to the provincial public guardian and trustee office, at which point the public guardian and trustee office took steps to take control of Mr. Hippy's finances. Despite the fact that Marilyn Nelson also has power of attorney for property in financial matters.
Yes, and I know that for an absolute fact because, as I said, I witnessed the signing of that power of attorney. I was one of two witnesses, you know, and went out to Ajax Pickering Memorial Hospital for that purpose. So I absolutely can swear that this is exactly what Arthur wanted, and this is what he did. And, you know, despite all of that, which is all supposedly enshrined in law, supposedly these are the rights we all have. We have the right of informed consent in every province of this country, and if we can't do that consent because we're incapacitated, we have the absolute right of appointing another person in order to make those decisions for us because they know what our wishes are. In this particular case, I know for a fact what Arthur's wishes were because I knew him for a decade. And I know for a fact that Marilyn followed all of the wishes that he would have asserted had he had the capacity to do so. He would have done nothing other than what she suggested and wanted because he trusted her, he was active with her in natural health. And yes, Arthur was not, he was not the kind of person who would dismiss all pharmaceutical products. But if there was a natural alternative, that's what he wanted, and he had made that clear to me over a long time. He made it clear to everybody by his own actions.
We should clarify one thing. When you said you had been to the hospital to sign the power of attorney, we should clarify that that was a year previous to him going into the hospital in 2010 with his stroke. at least a year earlier.
This was not in the middle of the melee. This was at the beginning. And as I recall, there was one incident I remember, and Marilyn had taken him to the hospital because it was very clear that he was, you know, having a definite problem. They didn't properly diagnose him. They didn't do any tests on him. They didn't do a CAT scan or any other kind of scan of him when they had him. And she left him there overnight thinking that he was in good hands. The next morning at about 7:30, they called him and they said, well, we're sending him home now. Do you want us to send him in a cab or are you coming to get him? Well, Marilyn was flabbergasted at this. She, you know, what in the flying blue blazes, because Arthur was clearly having difficulty. She went and collected him all right, and then she spent 5 days literally caring for this man like she was, a practitioner, and he was very much incapacitated. She even had to help him go to the bathroom. And she had to lie in his bed to make sure that he didn't roll off it. He wasn't even capable of staying in bed reliably, so she had to make sure that, you know, she was on the side that was going to make sure she was the railing between him and the floor. And then a few days later, she wound up having to, she took him back to the hospital again, this time by ambulance, because he was getting worse and worse. And the ambulance attendant said, "You've had him like this for 5 days? How did you do it?" And quite frankly, I don't know how she did it. I seriously don't know how she did it. But they mismanaged this case. I watched this guy get bounced from pillar to post with no help, no healing, no nothing, and then they slam him in a room. And I'll tell you, you know, he's not my best friend. He never was. But he was a really strong colleague in health freedom issues and a very, very nice and humorous and funny man. And I watched him go from that to a shadow of his former self, suffering. And every single thing that he suffered, I can personally say, I watched the genesis of that. And the genesis of it was not in the problem in his body. The genesis of it was the problem in the hospital. You know, I think I can say that fairly honestly, because I happen to be there and observe it. You know?
Right, and so I'll just explain, just to move away from this case a bit, just to so that people don't think, well, this is just a very sad and unfortunate case, and there must have been something there that triggered it, and I'm sure the doctors and nurses mean well, and so forth. In fact, this is not that rare a case. In St. John's, Newfoundland, for example, there was a case of a hospital that banned the two daughters of an 80-something-year-old woman because the daughters had complained about the care their mother was getting in the hospital. And so the hospital banned the daughters. Now, these are not people who... One of the daughters is a retired school teacher. The other daughter is a practicing medical doctor, and she was banned from seeing her own mother because she had legitimate concerns about the care of her mother. The other sister, the retired school teacher, was charged with assault by the nursing staff in the hospital, and that went to the court, through the courts as well. And again, so there we have a situation. Once again, if family members who have legal authority for individuals are banned from facilities, in this case, in St. John's, Newfoundland, every Friday, the staff would do what was essentially a report card, as the sisters called it. And if the sisters had been good, then they might get a phone call with their mother. It was very dreadful, very shocking to the sisters, especially to the medical doctor, who was just flabbergasted at this whole scenario. So that's another case. We have a case in Victoria, British Columbia, where a gentleman about the same age as Mr. Hippie in Ajax Pickering Hospital had a stroke in a Victoria, B.C. hospital, or was being treated for a stroke there. He was a retired medical doctor. His wife is still a practicing doctor. She's a researcher, a cancer researcher of some renown. She had concerns about her husband's treatment, and she, too, was banned from the facility, from the hospital. She went to court, and she was permitted to see him under a restricted regimen, again, because she had concerns. And so it's very difficult. People should be aware that all kinds of allegations can and are often made about family members that have no validity whatsoever. But families need to understand that the word of nurses, care aides, doctors, public agencies and authorities will usually be accepted over the word and even evidence of wrongdoing or inaccurate statements by healthcare providers.
Yeah,
it's essentially them against the family, and the healthcare providers almost always win out. Not because they are telling the truth. In many cases, they are not, and we have the evidence to show that. But simply because they're granted that leeway.
Unbelievable,
so
and you know the thing that really is shocking to me is the involvement of members of the families of these people who are medical professionals themselves and whose word is basically completely dismissed, even though they are members of the same medical association, qualified by the same medical colleges, licensed by the same organizations, working under the same insurance, health insurance, and all these different plans. And then all of a sudden, it's like, you know, they're Joe Blow citizen, and they've got no say whatsoever. So when people are thinking, oh, my doctor will protect me, they can't necessarily, because there's this little thing called standards of practice. And standards of practice is something I'm trying to educate people about, because what happens is doctors, and this is across the board, it's not just with seniors, standards of practice are established by medical associations across the country. Of course, the biggest one is the Ontario Medical Association, the OMA. Because it's the biggest, it tends to be the loudest and the strongest. And essentially what we're seeing now is we're seeing standards of practice that are being shrunk in terms of the list of options that are available to, you know, patients of all varieties. And then your doctor, your own doctor, who you would think would be there to protect you, is unable to offer you the treatment plan that he himself or she herself would come up with for you. That may be an integrated technique, it may be a natural technique, it may be anything, you know, that's designed. It's your doctor, after all. They're trying to make you well, aren't they? Well, the problem is, if it goes against standards of practice and they violate one, they lose their license. So you've got all these muggle doctors. Yeah.
They're certainly at risk. Right. Now, there's a an episode of a CBC radio show called White Coat Black Art in the past week, September 2013, first week of September, I believe. And it talked about, and there are good doctors in the system who are very much concerned about what's happening in the healthcare domain. And doctors who are, say, for example, witness some wrongdoing and report it, doctors, nurses, care aides, whatever, they are at risk of being shunned and attacked by their own organizations, by their unions, and so forth. This particular radio show features an interview with a doctor who witnessed essentially some form of malpractice and reported that doctor. It was fairly obvious and fairly serious. And the doctor, who was essentially the whistleblower in this case, was attacked by his own organization to such an extent that they alleged he was mentally ill, and he is fighting to save his medical career right at this point, simply because he decided to report a very dangerous procedure by a particular doctor. So, you know, there's a lot of pressure from in the healthcare system being exerted on even the good people who are trying, especially the good people who are trying to deliver healthcare in a proper fashion. And that's what we're trying to work with those people, and we have people working behind the scenes with us who are doctors and nurses and care aides and so forth, who know that a lot is not a lot of things are happening that shouldn't be happening, and that people are suffering and people are dying as a result of that. And
yes,
so I'm going to go back a bit to the hospital has the authority. Hospitals and nursing homes, they have usually the laws vary from province to province, but this is a trend that we study and we notice that the laws that govern the operation of hospitals and nursing homes often, if not always, permit them to simply ban families from seeing their loved ones, and so that's something to be aware of. The other thing that people should be aware of is that the public guardian and trustee, and there is one in every provincial government in Canada, the public guardian and trustee office has the authority to suspend or remove the legal appointments that a person has made for substitute decision making. So power of attorney for financial matters, substitute decision making documents for healthcare matters, they have the power, and in some cases, greater power, I would argue, than the courts do, to simply take away a person's rights and freedoms.
Well,
and to take over their life.
Well, hang on here. I mean, I know that's true, but I'm saying hang on here because I want people to pay real close attention. We're talking here about our rights as human beings in a supposedly free and democratic country to have our care managed the way we want it to be. We have that right. And yet, and the legal mechanisms are there to guarantee that. And yet, these people guarantee it, or overrun those guarantees, overrun those laws, take away those rights with impunity. And despite the fact that we have all these rights, nobody is getting told, well, here, you know, if you want to protect yourself, get a power of attorney. But nobody's being told when you sign a power of attorney. Bear in mind, you know, if you run into some bad apples in a hospital, they could take that away from you. So why is there even a power of attorney in the first place if they're going to ignore it at random? I mean,
well,
it boggles the mind.
Correct, and it's very tempting for us to advise people, and we often say that a power of attorney or any form of substitute decision-making document like a representation agreement or so on and so forth is not worth the paper it's written on, and certainly not worth the amount of money you pay to a lawyer to have it drawn up. We do say that, and it's true, but in the same, but we urge you to make sure that you have those documents in place because they'll at least give you something to hang on to, some authority of some sort that you can use, hopefully, to exert some direction over the person's care and safety. Here's how this happens and why this happens. Because the power of attorney, say for example, let's just talk generically power of attorney across Canada. As I say, they're called different things sometimes in different provinces. I think just to confuse the public, they could call them the same thing, but that would be
too simple,
too clear, and too easy for the public to understand. There used to be a trend called legal documents to be written in simple, straightforward, clear language. That's gone by the board, it seems. So anyway,
yeah.
Why this happens is because the power of attorney for personal care will say that you have the authority to make a decision over the person who grants you that authority if and when they are unable to make decisions themselves. But no one is aware of is that there are other laws that have been written that give other bodies the right to supersede the power of attorney legislation. And
yes.
For example, the public guardian and trustee offices operate under an act that gives them the authority to simply intervene without informing patient or the substitute decision maker. They can and often do intervene and set themselves up as the body that has the decision over the person's finances and assets, or over the person and their medical care and health care and so on and so forth, where they live, and sometimes they handle both. So they have that power to simply take it away. And that's happening across the country. That happened in the Hippie case. It happened in a case in British Columbia just this week that we were also working on.
That was the Mochak case? Are you talking about the Mochak case? Because, I mean, that one is a stunning example, as far as I'm concerned, a stunning example of what they can do. And I'm wondering where the remedies are.
Can you tell me a little bit more about what you mean by the remedy?
Well,
I think I know where you're going, but I'm not sure.
Well, I'm saying basically that, you know what, you're given these rights, and now they've written other legislation that is obviously affecting these rights. But clearly that's, you know, you're talking about a case for courts, and I'm wondering how it is that all of this could be handled in such a manner as to remove all the rights from an individual, remove their power of attorney, get rid of all that. Ultimately, it appears to me like the state is asserting ownership over all of us.
Correct. And in this case, I'll just explain this case a little bit. This case happened in Victoria, B.C. this past week. And in this particular case, the elderly father went into a nursing home. He was capable at the time and had gone into the nursing home to be with his wife, who was not expected to live long. He didn't want her to live there by herself. So he voluntarily went into the nursing home himself, and she died a few months later. And the elderly man has three adult children, one of whom has power of attorney for him. And the man was looking after paying his bills and things. He had a modest estate and owned a house and had pension and so forth, and most of the pension was going to the nursing home fees. And so there were a few other bills, but he had been doing that himself. And then, unbeknownst to the family, the nursing home decided to help the man out. And the family was, you know, thought this was sort of normal practice, since most of his pension goes to paying the nursing home fees. However, at some point later on, it became apparent that something very wrong had happened. And what appears to have happened in this case is that the nursing home, a social worker at the nursing home, appears to have taken over writing checks on the man's bank accounts and so forth, redirected mail without the man or the family being aware of this. Redirecting of mail is a federal offense, a criminal offense.
Yeah, it carries a 10-year prison sentence, as well as, I think, a $50,000 fine.
Right. Redirected mail, banking information, and so forth, And then one day, a process server from the bank showed up at the elderly man's bedside and said, "You owe," I believe it was something like $7,000 at this point, that the bank account was in overdraft. And the man was shocked. He had no idea, told his family, and the ball began to roll as soon as that happened. As soon as that was discovered, the process server showing up at the man's bedside, demanding the money, the nursing home suddenly took steps to declare the man incapable, but incapable of only managing his finances.
Mm-hmm.
So, and when they did that, they then referred the case immediately to the public guardian and trustee. Now, just like they did in Marilyn Nelson's case, where they did the same thing, they ignored the fact that this son had a power of attorney for personal care that he had provided to the nursing home. So this should not have been referred to the public guardian and trustee. The public guardian and trustee should have inquired and determined that the son did have power of attorney and should step in and take some actions and so forth. Instead, the public guardian and trustee refused to accept any evidence with regard to a power of attorney being in existence and claimed that it wasn't on a provincial registry. We don't have a provincial registry in British Columbia for powers of attorney. I don't think there is one across Canada. The public guardian and trustee was misleading the family, who did not really understand these issues at this point. No one does, really, if you're not part of the bureaucracy. The public guardian proceeded to take over the man's estate, not look into the issue of how the $7,000 overdraft was incurred, not investigate that at all, and instead blame the family for what happened. The family and the power of attorney tried to make good, said they would pay the bill, even though they hadn't incurred the charges themselves, neither had the father. And what has happened since then is that the public guardian and trustee went, the next step they took was sending the family, the man's son and grandson live in his home at his request and with the approval of the two other siblings that this was the agreement. The public guardian and trustee sent a letter to the family in May saying that they were being evicted because they were going to sell the house to pay them for the $7,000 debt. And essentially make a man and his young son homeless is what will happen. So they went to court. They scraped together some money, got a lawyer, went to court, and the decision came down this week that even though the man has power of attorney, even though he did not incur this debt, even though he was willing to make good on it, and the three siblings were united in their support of each other and their father, and they had a power of attorney document that was valid and legal, the court handed guardianship of the elderly man to the public guardian and trustee, and so on October 31st, this family is going to be evicted. They will become homeless. Thanks.
Boy, you know what? People hear stories like this, Lois, and the first thing they want to do is they go, "Why didn't they sue?" Well, they did. They are.
They did. And here's what the judge said. The judge said that while it's acknowledged that they're a loving family and they all have said that this is what their father wished, that's not enough for power of attorney, for conducting
enough.
A power of attorney properly. No.
The key thing is the
public guardian and trustee in this case has also, it appears, interfered with their mail and had it redirected. As well, not just of the elderly father's mail, but of the son's mail as well. And that was brought up in court, and the judge ignored that.
And are they appealing at least?
It's a little early to tell. The decision just came yesterday, so the family is reeling at this point in time.
Yeah, I would imagine. I mean, that it's called drop your jaw on the ground and let it rest there for a little while, because this is too much. This is too much.
And the problem is this family has already spent, I believe it was reported in court, $13,000 for legal fees to fight to gain guardianship of their father, so that the home wouldn't be lost, and they could make medical decisions for the father, and so on and so forth.
Yeah.
So they've already spent $13,000. The public guardian and trustee has had possession of the financial, has taken control of the financial situation for the last year and a half. They charge a fairly high fee. So the estate is being drained for their expenses, and on top of that, the public guardian and trustee is asking that the family pay the public guardian and trustee's legal costs.
Oof.
Now, this
insult
is a gentleman
after insult after injury after injury. This is disgusting.
Yes. This is, in my view, it's a predatory action by government agency.
And if you know, when you put that into a general terminology, this is where it really gets scary to me, is take the names and faces off the case and put down in front of your own eyes exactly what the government is capable of doing to any one of us. And it doesn't matter. Oh, my son's a doctor. He'll do fine as my P of A. He'll be able to protect me. He'll be able to ensure I get the kind of care I need. Well, no, he won't. No, he won't.
Well,
in fact, he'd be damn lucky to keep his license if he fights.
As a matter of fact, I'd like to just, if there is time, quickly read something written by a lawyer in Toronto with regard to his own mother and the treatment and care at a local Toronto hospital. This is a letter written to a newspaper by a lawyer by the name of Ted Nemitz. He is also a past chair of the Consent and Capacity Board, interestingly enough. He's writing in response to an article about someone else being parent being mistreated and denied treatment in hospital and died as a result. He writes, "My blood boiled as I read this article. In December 2009, my elderly mother was admitted to Sunnybrook Hospital. My mother also had a strong will to live. It was very clear from the start that the attending physician had, quote, written her off, end quote, due to her age and comorbidities, and had no interest in optimizing her medical condition. It was only due to a combination of both physician family members, so doctors in their own family, his siblings, and other persistent family members who screamed and begged for treatment that the attending physician and his team begrudgingly gave by then in an untimely manner. The experience has haunted our family and left deep, lasting scars. It is frightening that this approach is being taught to residents and medical students in this renowned teaching hospital." So that is an experience of a lawyer who works in the field, who he and his siblings, some of whom were doctors themselves, screamed and begged for treatment from the attending physicians and team of nurses and aides.
Yeah, now if that's going on at Sunnybrook, okay, as everyone knows, I live in Toronto, okay? Sunnybrook is not that very far from me. In fact, I could practically walk there from here, okay? This hospital is an incredible compound of different centers and research facilities and a massive, majorly famous trauma unit. They do everything at Sunnybrook, and they're known worldwide. If this stuff is going on at Sunnybrook, it is going on everywhere. What I also want to point out is that this harks back to something I found out about last year that absolutely turned my stomach. And if you've been paying attention, as a lot of people have, to the Obamacare issue, which now October 1, that kicks into place. And, you know, it's going to be a horror story south of the border, that's for sure. But the thing is that there's this little thing that's coming forward called the Liverpool Care Pathway. And it was developed over in the EU, and I know it's in force here. You can see it through the stories that Lois is telling us today. You can see it if you go to the seniorsatrisk.org website. You will see many, many cases similar to this. But I'll tell you, when I see what's going on in the EU, this Liverpool Care Pathway is seeping into our medical system. It means that they at the hospital are going to decide whether or not it is worth spending a dime on your rotting carcass. And if they don't want to spend a dime on you, they will put you on the Liverpool Care Pathway. That care pathway is a complete absence of care. They literally starve patients to death under the Liverpool Care Pathway. They starve them to death.
Yes, and I should explain, the Liverpool pathway gets its name from Liverpool, the city in the UK, where they developed it for palliative care purposes. And what that means is it's usually the administration of morphine and withholding food and water. And mm-hmm. So what happens is the patient gets weaker with the withholding of food and water, and the administration of morphine is increased, and it depresses the respiratory system. So over a period of two or three days, that will cause a person to die. It could be 3 or 4 days. It depends. But the essential thing is that the person dies of thirst and starvation and or respiratory failure as a result of morphine being administered. And that was a practice developed for palliative care of patients who had terminal illness and were in dire situations and so forth.
Yeah, it was to get around the euthanasia issue.
Well, no, not necessarily. Not when it was first developed, but it's been used for that and it's happening a lot in Canada. They don't use the term Liverpool pathway, and people can just Google Liverpool pathway, and you'll find a lot of information on it. And some of it will be information from government and agencies or advocacy care groups that are funded by government say that they're independent, but they're really not. And then you look a little more closely, look for those sites that might be a little more critical of Liverpool Pathway, and that's where you'll find the real truth of what is going on as we see it in Canada, across Canada right now.
Yes, I mean, we saw it in Arthur Hippie's case, because that was one of the first things they did was, oh, just let him go.
Just let him go, exactly. And the other thing is pushing of the do not resuscitate order. And they make a case that it's just terrible. You wouldn't want anyone to be resuscitated, as if there was one mechanism, one means, one practice for resuscitation. There is not. And in some cases, resuscitation might make perfect sense, and in other cases, not. But doctors, there's a great push. People are becoming more and more alarmed now. They go to visit their doctor, and all of a sudden they're being asked, do you want to do not resuscitate order on your chart,
mm-hmm.
and so on and so forth. And people are becoming suspicious and alarmed, people who know nothing about the larger issues we're talking about today. And we get reports of that coming through. So there's a real push. What happens in the healthcare system is everything you say to your doctor or your nurse or a social worker or a care aide, if you're in the hospital or a nursing home, everything that they might be able to use against you or your family will be documented. If you say that you're feeling sad, they'll say you're depressed, and therefore they can declare you incapable of making decisions because you're depressed.
I really want to point this out, too, because it's important. What we're seeing now, you look at the new standards of practice, the DSM-5 in the psychiatric industry, and I call it an industry for good reason because they're all about profit. But in the DSM-5, which basically is the guide for psychiatrists and psychologists across North America, they pretty much have any emotion in the spectrum of human emotions. If they think you've got more of that than your share, then you are suffering from a syndrome. For example, if you don't like what the government is doing and you get really irate about that, they will diagnose you with oppositional defiant disorder, and they will say, you're a sick person and you need to be hospitalized or medicated. And then it becomes a case of, if you need to be medicated for your own good, then we have to make sure that you get medicated for society's good, to protect society from you. So ultimately, we're all being turned into either a help to the collective or we're a danger to the collective. And heaven help us if we are a danger in their estimation, because there's no way out. There's just no way out.
Another case that we were assisting with last year in Victoria, B.C., an 82-year-old woman was in the hospital recovering very nicely from a fractured hip. A psychiatrist wandered by and determined that she was depressed. And so he had her admitted to the psychiatric ward of the hospital and taken out of the acute care ward. And shortly thereafter, he told her, I want to give you 12 electric shock treatments. She was horrified, and she said, I don't want those. And her granddaughter and grandson, her nearest relatives and those who are her legal substitute decision makers, although she's still capable, so they weren't making decisions for her. She and the family all objected, and the psychiatrist said, and in this case, Royal Jubilee Hospital Dr. Michael Cooper. He told the family and the woman, it doesn't matter. I'll declare you incapable under the Mental Health Act, and I can do what I want then. And he did. Mm-hmm. He declared her incapable under the Mental Health Act. The family quickly requested an emergency hearing on the matter, and within days there was a hearing held, and we were able to, working with the family, pulling together lawyers to help them, and we were able to successfully get her freed out of that hospital. But she has fled the province, and there are other people who fled the province as well. There are people in Ontario who have had to do the same, taking patients out of hospital to another province, because they were being improperly treated and inadequately treated. So these kinds of things are going on a lot right now in terms of this is the risk to people. It's not just people who are seniors, not in the least. We've had people in their 40s who've had the same situation where they have found themselves in hospital, and all of a sudden they are unable to make decisions, or they're trying to make decisions and the hospital is preventing them from making decisions. And these are not people who are necessarily mentally ill. We had one young man who was, and we normally deal with seniors, but occasionally we get people begging us, some other age groups begging us to help them because they have nowhere else to go. There are apparently all sorts of agencies that are willing to help So we hear and so we see. But we have people coming to us time and time again telling us that they've been everywhere and nobody else would do anything. And this is true. No one will do anything. Hospitals, doctors, nursing homes, they have ultimate authority. When people contact the police for help in these situations, the police often do not help. They often don't help. A case in point is in Ontario as well. A fellow by the name of Camille Parent in Peterborough has his mother is in a nursing home, and he became in this case has been widely reported. Became increasingly concerned about her marks on her and things that had happened, and the nursing home blamed it on other residents, and they said, oh, it's just another resident. So, but he became more and more suspicious. He installed a hidden video camera, and lo and behold, he found that it was not another resident. It was the care staff that were abusing his mother. Horrendous things. And this video has become quite quite widely distributed, not just across Canada but across the world, to our shame as a country. We have a care aide essentially fighting and manhandling this woman. We also see the care aide take a feces-laden rag and brush it across her face, and so forth. These are outrageous things. Outrageous things. When he tried to get police assistance to lay charges, just in the last week or so, the police have announced no charges will be laid because, why? The police and the Crown Prosecutors, Crown Prosecutor's decision whether or not to lay charges, the provincial Crown Prosecutor in Ontario decided that they couldn't lay charges despite the fact they have a video showing these acts of assault and endangerment of the person because there was, quote-unquote, no intent. Now, I don't know how they can determine that they were claiming that they were just going through proper care. How on earth you can take a feces-laden rag and wipe it past someone's face and there's people will have to judge for themselves whether it got contact or not. There was contact or not, but it's undeniable that this is an act of intimidation and terrorizing, really, of an elderly woman with Alzheimer's in a most despicable manner, in a way that has to be intentional.
Well, yeah, this is it. I mean, come on. Yeah, that's not a mistake most people would make unless they had dead nose. You know, he couldn't smell anything, and blind eyes,
couldn't
see anything.
It's quite apparent what this person was doing. They were punishing the woman, and it's not like it was accidental. It isn't accidental. It is quite a deliberate action, and yet the police will not act in that case. And we have many cases where the police will not act, and despite that, we have a federal government that is crowing about having increased the penalties for elder abuse, criminal code penalties for elder abuse, and they supposedly had increased that about a year ago, and yet these laws, the laws that are on the books, because these are criminal code offenses, assault and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
Whether they're called elder abuse or not, though most of the acts that fall under elder abuse, financial fraud, physical abuse, sexual abuse, etc., they all fall under the criminal code. So why is it that seniors are not given the protection that the rest of us have under the criminal code? If someone assaults the rest of us, we can make a complaint with the police, and if there is evidence of that action, then that person will be charged.
Exactly.
But that's not the case. It's not the case for people in nursing homes and elderly people in hospitals.
Yeah, and exactly how and why is it that these people are indemnified from punishment for things that are criminal acts? You know, we're talking about the unauthorized redirection of mail, interference in financial matters, the stealing of assets, the stealing of property, the administration of unwanted medical practices. I know in Arthur's case, there was unwanted and unnecessary surgery, all kinds of stuff going on that is, under anybody's definition, is assault, and definitely assault with intent, and yet these guys are getting away with it. So how is it that there is legislation that conflicts with itself and allows this stuff to go on? Is it the split between federal and provincial legislation? Is it the fact that the federal government, technically speaking, doesn't have the authority under the Constitution to determine health care? But the provinces are going crazy.
The federal government does have a role to play when we're talking about criminal code offenses. Criminal code is a federal piece of legislation, so that that it puts it squarely in the lap of the federal government. Healthcare administration and healthcare consent legislation and so forth, those are provincial matters. So both levels of government are responsible for what's going on now. I'm going to go back to the Arthur Hickey case for a moment with regard to medication. During the Consent and Capacity Board hearing, and the Consent and Capacity Board is called a quasi-judicial body, meaning it's not exactly part of the court system, but it's one step lower. They are able to make certain decisions within a limited framework.
Technically speaking, as a tribunal,
Yes. During that hearing, the hospital and doctors had stated that Arthur Hickey was no longer being given Haldol. And about 6 weeks later, it was discovered by accident that indeed they had, that was not true. They were secretly administering Haldol to him. At least on four occasions, they admitted that. And the lawyers that were involved for the family had warned them that if they had administered any Haldol or any other antipsychotic or neuroleptic drug, that would be considered battery. And they admitted to the battery because under law, and in Ontario, all this applies, but there will be similar laws in every province, under the law in Ontario, it is a criminal offense. It is battery if doctors administer medication without consent. And doctors are permitted to administer a single dose of medication in an emergency situation without consent. But they must tell the patient or the legal substitute decision maker as soon as possible thereafter. In this case, Mr. Hippie was given Haldol on four occasions, the substitute decision maker was never informed, so they committed battery. But the Consent and Capacity Board simply ignored that.
Yeah, see, I'd call that assault. I'd call that assault.
Well, it is. Well, battery is a form of assault. So
but it's a more minor form of assault. Battery is unwanted touching. Right? It sounds like a little nastier than it is, but you actually have to inflict pain to have it called assault and battery. And, you know, when you're talking about something being injected or ingested against one's will, I'd rather they socked me in the jaw than did that.
It, It is invasive treatment and abuse of one's body to administer medication without consent, without legal consent. And so they so there were instances now of three doctors at Ajax Pickering Hospital, one of whom is the associate chief of staff, that's Dr. Staff, who have been found guilty of acting unlawfully, illegally. Mm-hmm. So Dr. Stephen Fishman, Dr. Staff, and Dr. Carmen Price. So
yeah.
All three of those doctors have, but there have been absolutely no repercussions whatsoever for these doctors.
No, and I can tell you from my own knowledge, having met these guys, okay, at least Staff and Price I've met. Fishman I have not. But the other two, Staff and Price, I can tell you these guys they're not interested. They gave us no indication in the meeting we had that they had any interest in Mr. Hippie's well-being at all. The only interest they had was in being obeyed. And when I personally challenged them about the use of Zyprexa and asked them, were they aware that Zyprexa had caused this criminal award? They said, oh, yeah, we're aware. I said, and still you prescribe this? I said,
I must explain something. Every medication has risks, and people need to be aware of this. And this is important so that they can understand how to handle the situation so they don't get caught in a similar situation. The legal substitute decision maker is the way the law is written with respect to healthcare consent is that the legal substitute decision maker must take into consideration doctors' information from medical experts. Okay, so that's important. The legal substitute decision maker is not permitted to demand any treatment because only a doctor is able to provide medical treatment legally in Canada. A legal substitute decision maker can make care consent decisions. In other words, they can say, supposedly, they're able to say yes or no to whatever a doctor proposes. Now, in this case, the Hippie case, apparently the Consent and Capacity Board is saying that you are not able to make a decision. But the reason they say they gave for demanding that Marilyn Nelson consent to the doctor's treatment plan or forfeit her authority as a substitute decision maker is because they claim that she is imposing her views and her wishes, and we know that's not true, but that's what the Consent and Capacity Board said, that she is imposing her wishes and her views on Mr. Hippie's care plan, and also because they claim that she has not taken into consideration medical expertise, and that is also not true, but that's what they claim. So people have to be mindful not to get caught in a trap of demanding that certain treatments be given, but you can say yes or no to any treatment that is proposed. And the second thing is you simply can't turn your back on doctors and say, well, you know, I know better and I'm going to do whatever I want, because mm-hmm. unless you're a doctor and the treating doctor, you don't have that authority. So I say that to people just so that they kind of mind their P's and Q's as they go through this and they don't have any misperceptions, because it's so easy to get caught in these traps. And once you get caught in the trap, once you get into a situation where you're in disagreement or have concerns about the care of someone, you can rest assured that everything that you say will be written down and held against you, and so on and so forth. So you must be very careful in those situations.
Yeah. So definitely, if you have if you have a relative in that kind of situation, or if you're even contemplating that situation for yourself or a family member, it would be really wise to learn all the ins and outs before even going in there. Because clearly that system can turn against you very, very easily and very, very quickly. Just to break away for a moment, I do want to let people know that they can call in now. We've only got about a half an hour before the end of the show, but certainly that's enough time to take a call or two. And if you have a story that you want to share that fits in, or if you are, especially if you're in Canada and want help from seniors at risk, please give us a call. The number is on the website under Station 1. I'll give it to you now. It's 888-627-6008. So if you want to call in and talk to Lois, mention your own story, ask a question, 888-627-6008 is our toll-free number here at Zero Point. And now back to Lois. Lois, I got to tell you, you know I talk to a lot of people about a lot of issues, but, you know, when it comes to the absolute hubris and complete lack of compassion, lack of care, lack of human decency that is being foisted on senior citizens who've done nothing to anyone, you know, all they're doing, they're living their lives, and because they run up against a problem of some sort, you know, all of a sudden the government steps in and makes their life a living hell. Just a living hell. And these are people who are charged with and set up by government to protect us. Well, we need people now to protect us from our protectors. And that is... that is a situation where you find that happening, you know, like, where can I emigrate to, is my first thought. What country in the world can I go to where I can at least have what I want? You know, Arthur, for example, is not uneducated. Arthur is very well educated, and so is Marilyn. As an activist for 20 years, she knows her stuff, and what they fail to recognize is that where, you know, they tried to make Marilyn look like a nut bar, and, you know, that she was imposing her own will, but they failed to acknowledge that she is an activist in health freedom, and Arthur was right there with her, and she is connected with some of the best healthcare professionals in the entire world. And it is these people at Carmen Price is fighting.
One of the reasons that these cases arise and that they continue and that people's lives are turned into, as you put it, a living hell, is that the way the system has been structured in Canada, the healthcare system working with the legal system, they've written the laws to favor themselves. And I'll give you an example. For example, these doctors at HS Pickering Hospital are no one can understand right now. Marilyn Nelson would like to have Arthur Hippie transferred to another facility. There is another facility and doctors who are willing to accept him as a patient. But HS Pickering Hospital and the doctors there refuse to allow him to be transferred. Lawyers tell Marilyn Nelson that she has every right to move him out. Doctors tell her that. Nobody can understand why this won't happen. It won't happen because the authorities are permitting the doctors at HS Pickering Hospital to commit wrongdoing. They are permitting this to happen. None of the public authorities, police, public guardian and trustee, a health ministry, none of them are doing anything to prevent the abuse by the doctors in the hospital, in this case, against this man and woman. One of the reasons, and a thing that will affect many, many people, is that if you try to go to the courts to get some resolution, You can try going through the internal bodies. That's the recommended first step as you try and resolve these matters with these agencies, whether it be a hospital, nursing home, public health care communities, for example, in Ontario, the community care access centers or whatever. It's recommended you go through them first. But in fact, what we find is that they are very, very unwilling to cooperate with families. We, again, have case after case of people getting negligent, substandard care and response from agencies like that, who should be more inclined to provide service in a professional manner. In fact, they do not. For example, in Arthur Hippie's case, the Community Care Access Center, East Central CCAC, they've actually stated on forms that describe Arthur Hippie and his family that Arthur Hippie is blind. They put that on a form. Hello?
Yeah.
Hello? Yeah, oh, okay, sorry, there was a break in the connection here. So in one of the forms, they stated he... and that was incorrect. In another case, we've had other agencies refusing to cooperate, the public guardian and trustee. They essentially were harassed, Marilyn Nelson, for a year and a half trying to take over Mr. Hippie's estate and so forth. Finally, when it was determined that the Dr. Fishman at Ajax Pickering Hospital acted unlawfully, the public guardian and trustee was sent a letter about that, and then there was no further engagement by them at this time. However, public guardian and trustee is likely to take on making decisions in the healthcare arena if Marilyn Nelson loses her power of attorney. So she's appealing that decision right now. But here's the situation that she faces and all the other families face. The hospital and doctors have essentially unlimited funds for lawyers. And this funding is virtually all subsidized by taxpayers. People will sometimes make the argument that, oh, no, doctors pay an annual fee for their legal insurance. They pay a fraction of it, a teeny portion. Provincial governments pay virtually all, and by that I mean we taxpayers, pay most of the... we are the ones who subsidize most of the funding for doctors and hospitals, lawyers. So they have an unlimited source of lawyers, and families are left on their own. They have no one to turn to. Legal aid won't help them. There's an organization in Toronto called the
Elder Abuse. Yeah.
Yes, Advocacy Center for Elder Abuse, but they won't provide any assistance when situations go into the legal arena.
No.
And in this case, we actually had one of our volunteers who is a lawyer but isn't a litigation lawyer contact ACE to ask for help. That was about a year ago, and they declined. And more to the point, they shared that information, ACE did, with the hospital without our knowledge. That Marilyn Nelson was planning to take this matter to court. So there's very little support for the individual in a legal realm, and all of our taxpayer dollars are going to support lawyers, doctors, hospitals, and staff. When we get to staff, for example, the case that I mentioned in Peterborough of Camille Parent's mother being assaulted. The other factor that we often run into, and it varies from province to province, is that especially unionized healthcare staff, they will often have immunity from prosecution. So there is when there are no this is just like raising children. When there are no consequences, then all hell will break loose. And that's
exactly.
And our seniors.
And you see,
that.
You know, this is mind-boggling to me, because what you've been describing here is essentially a network. It's a system. It is not just, oh, well, I can talk to this board or that board and everything will be fine. They are sort of incestuous. This whole system is incestuous with itself. It is essentially, if one board can't handle it, then they'll bring in a phalanx of doctors or a phalanx of lawyers. They got everything set up in their benefit, because ultimately, in every case, it's all about control, and control leads to profit, and profit goes somewhere. It's like getting a cancer diagnosis guarantees the medical cartels $250,000 right off the hop, just to tell you, guess what, you've got cancer. Boom, the system goes into play. And now those systems that are so nasty and so damaging are now spreading to our seniors, they're spreading to our children, they're spreading to ourselves. And, you know, there are very few organizations out there who have the guts and the stick-to-itiveness, as yours does, to go in and fight for what's right. So where is there any resolve here? Do we see any resolve? Do we see any wins? Are all these cases being fought for nothing? Like, what can we do?
Well, one of the things, we do see some wins. We have actually helped a number of families get out of the clutches of the public guardian and trustee in Ontario, in British Columbia. For example, just in the last 6 months, a number of people. But that usually requires a lawyer, and so we work with some good doctors behind the scenes, good lawyers behind the scenes, you know, people who are volunteering to help. The key thing that is exceedingly important, that because the doctors and the healthcare industry and so on and so forth are working together, and the lawyers and so forth, and they have been able to successfully lobby for funding and to the tune of you know, millions, mega millions, the public has no one left to assist them. No one whatsoever. We don't have access to funds. It's all on us individually, and it is extremely costly. It is, for example, I mentioned $13,000 for this family that can scarcely afford it to try and protect the family home, and they were told, no, the government's just going to come and take it, to pay for a $7,000 debt that was incurred by another government employee that is not being investigated. That is not appropriate. What we need to do is stand together as individuals, because if individual families try to fight this on their own, they will lose. It's not a matter of if they will lose. They will lose. It's a matter of when, mm-hmm. and a matter of how much money it will cost them, whether it will deplete their entire net worth or whatever. So what we need to do is we need to work together, and that's what the Seniors at Risk Coalition is all about, is pulling people together so that we can work to restore the rights and the freedoms that are being eroded, that are being erased by the legal industry. And I should tell the listeners that if people think that our legislators actually are the ones who make the laws, that's wrong. It's the lawyers who write them, the legislators rubber stamp them, and often don't even read the legislation that they're passing, and they certainly don't understand it very well, most of them. Some of them do, but the vast majority of our provincial and federal politicians simply are in a rubber stamping exercise. And, for example, in one case, the the former deputy speaker of the House of Commons, an MP by the name of Denise Savoie in Victoria, told a family that who had gone to them for help with abuse of a family member in a nursing home in her area, that she should just, quote unquote, leave it to the lawyers. So, in other words, a member of parliament who is the deputy speaker, fairly high ranking, that was her full contribution to a situation that ultimately saw the death of this family member in a nursing home. Leave it to the lawyers.
It's amazing to me how much money these people make to be that stupid.
Well, they're not stupid. They do know what's going. They do know what's going on, and they are. Our politicians are being lobbied, and I believe we need to take collective action as individual citizens to lobby our politicians and tell them, in no uncertain terms, they're not getting elected if they are not going to do something very practical about this. I'm not under any sort of illusions about how difficult this will be. The lobbyists for the medical industry, for the legal industry, they will be in there protecting their turf at every step of the way. But as people, we have the numbers. We can at least bring pressure to bear on the elected politicians, because without elected politicians, then whatever party it is in power or who wants power, be it at the federal or provincial level, if they don't get their politicians elected, they won't have power. So citizens, we as citizens, if we act collectively and strongly and we stand up and say this is an outrageous thing, that we have our rights being so eroded that innocent people are being harmed and kept essentially kept prisoner in healthcare facilities, and have their assets stripped from them and so forth by government agencies who are accountable to no one, like the public guardian and trustee, that has to stop, and we have to put measures in place to either replace those agencies or to have the laws applied.
It seems to me that these agencies are essentially, they have lost their purpose in life. Their purpose, the reason they were set up, was to protect the individual. That was the purported reason to set them up. Not so that they could steal people's assets, not so that they could override the law, not so they could take people's rights away, not so they could keep their families from being with them in a time of emotional stress and emotional need, not to guarantee that the system could jam them full of whatever medication and whatever treatment that was going to be foisted on them, but to protect our rights. And if these organizations across the country have had their purpose altered by any motivation, then they are all breaking the law, and they should all be investigated, and we should all be standing up and saying, no damn way are we going to let these people harm our people. No damn way. And I have lived in this country all my life, and over many, many years, including with my own grandparents, I remember my mother crying her eyes out because my grandfather and grandmother, in their elder years and in their last few years, they each had to be put in a nursing home, but they were separated. They'd never been separated in their lives. And they not only put them in different rooms, they put them in different buildings. And I got to tell you, this was back in the late 50s. This has not gotten any better. In fact, it's gotten worse. And unfortunately, I think one of the things that I've learned from my loose association with your organization, which I think is phenomenal, is that people are so unaware of what goes on that all of a sudden they find themselves in a morass they can't get out of. It's like it traps you. You called it a trap. It is a trap. You are ensnared. You are basically hijacked and kidnapped. Everything about you becomes government property. And people don't
That's a particularly good point, just to pick up on what you've been saying here. Indeed, the purpose of the public guardian and trustee has been perverted, in my view. And I should point out a couple of things to people, that when the public guardian and trustee is given guardianship of the person, which happens quite a bit, the public guardian and trustee never sees that person, doesn't know them.
Don't.
They may visit once. To make a perfunctory visit to the site, so that they can say they visited once, but they have no particular expertise. They have no, and there's no. It's not incumbent upon them to do any to become informed about the issues that a family member might do in terms of doing research and becoming informed about the health conditions and the treatments and so forth. They have no special expertise in that. They don't know the individual. And so that's on the personal side. When the public guardian and trustee assumes guardianship over the person, when they assume guardianship over the estate or finances, not only will they often put a caveat or a lien on property and so forth, and seize bank accounts and whatnot. They also will be, from day one, will be depleting the assets of that individual, not just through their fees, which are acknowledged to be high, but they don't even reveal what the fees are, what the expenses are. Once the public guardian and trustee takes over as guardian, they do not report to any family members, anyone.
And I got to bust in here for 1 second and tell people they will not tell anyone in advance that they actually charge you for anything. It's supposed to be a government agency, and most people think that if it's a government agency taking over that there are no fees,
yeah.
You know, and they don't discuss it with you. They don't talk to you about that, and they don't indicate that they're going to be billing for anything. But then they turn around and bill for bloody everything.
And in many cases, they actually mislead family members. They'll often, I will use the word trick because they mislead and trick people. They will often deliberately contact family members other than the power of attorney, and try to elicit some sort of an agreement from them. Now,
mm-hmm.
often these people are getting a phone call right out of the blue. They have no idea what the subject matter is, and they're saying, well, yes, I guess so. That would be good. And, I guess if we need... They have no idea what they might be agreeing to. Then the public guardian uses those words against them to seize control of the estate and the assets. And that seems to be what they're mostly interested in, but they also go after and seize the person when there is a desire by the healthcare facility to ensure that the family has no role to play and will not be able to interfere with the care and treatment that the healthcare facility and doctors wish.
Yeah, they like those phone calls. I guess that's one piece of advice we should give people. If you are confronted with a call from the public guardian trustee's office, tell them to send it to you in writing. Don't speak to them.
Well, just tell them, here's my email. I'm sorry, I have to go out. Could you just send me a quick email? I'm going to be away for a while. Just put them off. Do not
put them off. Don't talk to them because they'll take it.
Yeah.
I mean,
and unless you have information from them in writing, you cannot trust what they will say verbally. And we've had case after case. Again, I sound like a broken record, but it is true. We get cases that are almost carbon copy of one another. From one province to right across Canada, it does not matter. Even though the laws are slightly different in each province, the issues are exactly the same, and the tactics used against families to mislead, to confuse, to trip up, are virtually identical.
Yeah.
So get it in writing. Engage with them through email or letters. And anything you say verbally will be documented by the public guardian and trustee.
By the nursing home, you got to realize when they call you, you need your Miranda rights, because anything you say may be held against you in a court of law.
Yeah.
That's exactly what's in the Miranda rights.
I'm not sure if we sometimes get a lot of our informal knowledge about the law from TV, and I don't know whether that applies in Canada.
That's actually true in both countries, and yes, it is.
And I have
paralegal training, so yes, it is the case. They call it the Miranda rights in the States, but mm-hmm. we have the same rights here. Anything
right,
that we say may be held.
Name. Mm-hmm.
So we have the
right
not to self-incriminate. We have the right not to say anything without a lawyer present. We have the right not to admit to anything that might cause us harm in court. We have all those
correct.
Rights. We both have them in both countries, but people do not know that this has to apply everywhere. You know, I mean, it's scary, Lois. I wish we had more time. We've been 2 hours. Time flies when you're having fun, and we've come to the end of our time slot, which is unfortunate. But tell us, what your website address is. I want people to go to that site. I want people to learn what's going on, and I want you to tell them what they can do to support Seniors at Risk Coalition.
All right. The website is seniorsatrisk.org, and that's all spelled out, seniorsatrisk.org. And if you...
Oh, seems we've lost Lois. At any rate, seniorsatrisk.org is the website for this organization. I will put it on the record now. Thank you so much, Lois, for joining us today. It was a fabulous discussion and very much needed in everybody's life. You have to know these things because you just never know when the law is going to come down on you in a way that you did not expect and cannot deal with. And the life and the quality of life of a family member or even your own can be affected that badly. So that was Zero Point for Saturday, September 14th, and I hope you'll be with us in a couple of weeks when we'll bring you more exciting information from the world at large. This is Dee Nicholson from Zero Point for Dr. Christopher Holmes and BBSRadio.com. Thank you so much for joining us, and please join us in 2 weeks' time. Good night, and God bless.